From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in all 50 states. For the first time since January, the number of COVID cases is rising in every state in the country. We don't say that to alarm you. The evidence is clear that the Delta variant of this virus is much more transmissible than previous versions of COVID, but the vaccines are still effective. The vast, vast majority of hospitalizations and deaths are happening in unvaccinated people. President Biden and his team have recently said, we don't have a pandemic in the vaccinated population. But millions remain unvaccinated here and around the world. As the New York Times detailed this week, the drug maker Pfizer recently announced that vaccinated people are likely to need a booster shot to be effectively protected against new variants of COVID-19, and that the company would apply for Food and Drug Administration emergency use authorization for a booster shot. Top government health officials immediately and emphatically announced that the booster is not necessary for now, and held firm to that position even after Pfizer's top scientist made his case and shared preliminary data with them last week. And this has led to some confusion. Should the nearly 60% of adult Americans who have been fully vaccinated seek out a booster or not? Is the protection that has allowed them to see loved ones and go out to dinner, for example, fading? Top scientists say, not yet. And Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a former ER physician, wrote this week, quote, if recent history is any guide, booster shots are coming, and we need to understand what that means for everyone, end quote. She notes there is slowly emerging data on how long the vaccines provide protection. And so far, the answer to that question looks promising. While we wonder if boosters are on the horizon, we also wonder when children of all ages might become eligible for the vaccines. But kids have handled COVID much better than adults. Writing for MedPage Today, Dr. Vinay Prasad argues that our first ethical priority is not to children, but to vulnerable adults around the world, especially in countries with severe outbreaks. Prasad writes that we face a values choice that will resonate for decades to come. And he writes that the United States must choose not to put its own children first, while instead sending more vaccines to people around the world who don't currently have access to them. This hour, we explore what happens next with vaccines. I'd like to welcome our guest now. Dr. Angela Branch is co-director of the Vaccine and Treatment Evaluation Unit at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Branch, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Dr. Ann Falsey, co-director of the URMC Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit. Dr. Falsey, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
And Marjorie Shaw is here. Dr. Shaw is a member of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee, an associate professor in the Department of Medical Humanities and Bioethics. Marjorie, welcome. Thanks for being back with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Evan.
Let me just start with Dr. Branch and Dr. Falsey just on the vaccine side. On the science side, Dr. Branch, are the vaccines as effective as you had hoped they would be at this stage of the pandemic, more so? And how do you see them stacking up against the Delta variant?
Good question. I think the vaccines are actually more effective than I had hoped they would be. To have vaccines that have shown efficacy in the trials as high as 95-96% was not something that we imagined when we started this whole process. We would have been happy with 70%. And so all these vaccines are very effective against symptomatic illness and nearly 100% effective against hospitalizations and death. And that's true along several measures. First of all, the vaccine protection seems to last pretty long. We have data now showing that the effectiveness of these vaccines is well into the 8th month after vaccination and probably even longer than that. So that's a really good sign. The other thing we're finding is that even as the virus mutates and emerges, that critical protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death isn't really changing that much. Yes, there might be some more breakthrough mild infections, but for the things that we really care about, people dying, people becoming severely ill and debilitated from COVID, the vaccines are doing really well against all the variants, including Delta.
Dr. Falsey, how do you see it?
I think Dr. Branch summarized it quite well, that on an individual basis, I think that we can be confident that we are still well protected against severe disease. including the variants. But, you know, everybody asks, well, when do I need my booster? And it is a area of active research. These are the things we're looking at with the people in the trial, but also real-world data that includes folks that weren't in the trials, those with immunocompromising conditions, people that are exceptionally debilitated. So it's important to look at the entire picture.
I received a Johnson & Johnson vaccine several months back. I've been tremendously grateful and, feel great. I think I'm like a lot of people. I'm a little bit surprised that we haven't seen J&J apply for maybe not even a booster, but just kind of going to a two-dose regimen. I know it's been studied in thousands of patients, and that study is ongoing with J&J, so that could change eventually. But the Washington Post, Dr. Falzy, recently covered a question that a number of people are asking, which is this: is it necessary to combine the Johnson & Johnson vaccine with another vaccine, an mRNA vaccine? And they talked to people, some who even work in the medical field, who've said, look, I got a J&J, it's been a number of months, I'm going to seek out one dose of an mRNA vaccine, even though right now that is not a recommended course. What do you say about that, Dr. Falzy?
Well, I would say it's a great question, and that's why it's a field of active research. And in fact, we are doing that very study at the U of R right now. We are looking, it's called the mix and match study. And so we are trying to evaluate whether boosters are well tolerated and produce a good immune response. And can you mix and match the different schedules? Get Pfizer, get J&J, or vice versa. And immunologically, there may be an advantage to certain schedules, going with one first and one later. But you really do have to do the evaluation. We don't expect there'll be severe side effects by mixing and matching or boosting. But we really have to be data driven. You know, as the good Dr. Fauci says, that we need to do the studies and see what's best for people before, you know, just unleashing and saying it's the Wild West, go out and get whatever you want, because there could be unintended consequences.
Dr. Branch, do you agree that, I think everyone agrees and understands more study is necessary, but do you have any expectation that there should be any complications for those who pursue a mix and match approach?
Well, the early evidence suggests that there isn't. There's at least one study from the UK of people who got a dose of AstraZeneca, and then they got an mRNA vaccine. And in that, which is not very large, but the data is really promising that, in fact, mixing those two vaccines produced a very strong immune response, and it seemed to be well-tolerated and safe. So our expectation and our hope is that it is safe, but I absolutely agree with Dr. Falzy, which is that, and I think this is a legitimate concern. These vaccines it's still very early in the process, and there will be unknowns. And so I think it's best to do the work of understanding the safety and the effectiveness of a strategy like that before we make recommendations.
Yeah, and then just I think another common question, Dr. Falzy, is how we get a sense for how durable immunity will be. And so forgive my ignorance on this, but I've been reading recently that there is some hope that the vaccines are showing a trajectory of durability that's better than we even hoped for, that it could be pretty long lasting, maybe more than 6 months, maybe more than a year, maybe well beyond. Absent a sample size of not only patients, but also the amount of time passed, how do we know? Are we looking for T cells? Are we looking for certain indicators that the vaccines are still kind of sort of cranking? Or is it something else? How are we going to get a sense for how long the vaccines are going to be providing protection?
Yeah, I don't think we can do a blood test and use that as a early predictor. Unfortunately, only time will tell, and a sufficient time has to go by for us to do, whether it's B cells, T cells, antibody, or whatever immunologic measure you take. But there are many large studies with lots of people, and those are ongoing. And so over time, we collect their blood and, you know, look at different parameters, and then start looking at breakthrough infections. And so, you know, the studies are now 8 months in. And once you get a couple of time points, you can actually, you know, calculate what you would predict is the fall off in protection. But you can't skip that step. We need a couple of time points to say, okay, your antibody levels were at 80%. Now they're down to 50%, and you can project. And that's why I think, you know, I think Pfizer has come under some criticism for the approach and the announcements with boosters. But, you know, I think we sometimes are playing catch up. And so I like to be proactive. They need the studies to look at the immunology of the boosters. And they could even do the bureaucracy and apply to the FDA and get approvals, which sometimes can take a while. That doesn't mean you recommend them at a certain point, but at least you're laying the groundwork so that you're ready if you decide, you know what, I think more is better, and we need to do that now. And the other thing I just think that people need to remember is, you know, I think we expect there will be fall off in protection for any illness, so mild illness. And the important thing that we're looking at is severe illness. As this virus may well settle into the usual, you know, cadre of viruses that make us sick.
Right. And so before I turn to Marjorie Shaw for some questions on what we perhaps should be doing, not just what we can be doing, let me just ask Drs. Falzi and Branch about some of these next stages. And I know a lot of this has been speculation, but there's plenty of talk about how long we go before we conclude that COVID will become endemic, and or that it will be a sort of in that rotating group of illnesses like the flu, in which we get an annual shot, that we are tailoring new vaccines to whatever the current mutation is, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the speculations I was reading recently was that we have vaccinated slowly enough and that this virus has mutated enough and it has taken root enough that it is too late to contain it in a way that essentially wipes it out, that we will be living with it in some form or fashion, but we don't exactly know if that means it changes annually, if we get annual shots, et cetera. So let me start with Dr. Falzi. I mean, what can we reasonably say about all of that so far?
Well, I think a number of people would have predicted from the get-go that it would become endemic. It's just hard to stamp out a respiratory virus in entirety, like something like smallpox or even polio. So I think the vaccine hesitancy and the slow vaccination has made the job more difficult because of mutations. But, you know, these are viruses that tend to mutate. We have four natural sort of seasonal coronaviruses, which may have entered the human population 100,000 years ago. And so I think it's very likely that this will settle into one of the viruses that we deal with. Whether or not you need a vaccination, I think, is yet to be defined. You know, so for those other coronaviruses that people get sick with, for the most part, they're very mild illnesses in children. And in adults, as we accumulate underlying conditions, they can be more severe. But again, generally, they're not so severe that vaccine programs have been developed. So if most of the population either gets infected or is vaccinated such that the adult infections are now all reinfections, and those are, you know, not nice illnesses, but, you know, you're not ending up in the hospital, I think there will be a public policy debate about annual vaccinations. So, unanswered question quite yet, but I expect it that it's going to be with us for, you know, the predictable future.
Okay, Dr. Branch?
Yeah, I think the idea of whether or not a virus becomes endemic or not has really to do with two things. One is transmissibility. So SARS coronavirus 1, which caused disease primarily in China, sort of disappeared after a couple of years, which was unexpected. You know, we'd never had a respiratory virus do quite that before. And so I think, but what's the difference between SARS-1 and SARS-2 is SARS-2 is much more transmissible. It's transmissible between people, and as it mutates, it just becomes more transmissible, as we're seeing with the Delta. So I think that, more than anything, will drive this question of becoming endemic or not. The other point, of course, is what happens with the immunity that we get, either from vaccination or from natural infection. For most respiratory viruses, after you become infected the first time, you develop some sort of partial immunity that stays with you for the rest of your life. And so something we still don't have the answer to is how long does immunity against SARS coronavirus 2 last? Is it partial? Is it complete and total? And will it 5 years from now, if you never get vaccinated or never get infected or not, still continue to prevent you from becoming severely ill or ending up in the hospital? And so I think those are the questions that are going, the answer to that, those questions is what's going to drive vaccination policy going forward. And so it's still very much something we're going to have to wait and see on.
Talking to Drs. Angela Branch and Ann Falsey from the Vaccine and Treatment Evaluation Unit at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Marjorie Shaw is with us, who is a member of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee and a professor in the Department of Medical Humanities and Bioethics. And listeners, as we talk about these issues, if you've got questions on what comes next with vaccines, we'll be talking about what we know about vaccines in children and authorization and where we go next. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. If you're calling from Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Dr. Shaw, when you look at the vaccine rollout here, we're now at a point where essentially adults in this country who want to be vaccinated are vaccinated or are on their way to being vaccinated. And a lot of parents are waiting eagerly for authorization for their youngest children to get authorized for vaccination. Meanwhile, we have outbreaks around the world. And what we're looking at, there's new data this morning in graph form, and it's just striking to me. In countries that have high rates of vaccination, the United States, the UK, Israel, what we are seeing is high rates of new cases, but not high rates of hospitalization and death. It's happening. People are dying and they're being hospitalized, but not nearly commensurate with the case rate like we saw 4, 6, 8 months ago. But in nations that are not vaccinated, the rates of hospitalization and death are devastating, particularly in parts of Asia that have resisted this pandemic pretty well. And it leads to some questions about what should we be doing with vaccine stocks right now. And I'd love to sort of get some opening thoughts from you before we get specific on how you see all of this happening right now. What's on your mind?
Sure. Thanks, Evan. So I think what's important is the distinction that you've just made between the consequences of the vaccine. Are we talking about death or are we talking about illness? And we've heard my colleagues, Dr. Branch and Dr. Falsey, talk about how the vaccine protects us from most people who have gotten the vaccine, protect from even hospitalization, and it is the unvaccinated who are at the greatest risk. And so when you think about a global, it is a global pandemic, right? And so everybody will remain vulnerable until we have vaccination across the globe. And so how do we think about doing that? And it's really important for governments to think about their populations, but only in the context of does it make sense given the injury and illness that happens to the individuals who get infected? And so that distinction that you've made between death or mild illness is a pretty significant distinction.
So when let me read a little bit more about what Dr. Vinay Prasad recently wrote in MedPage under the headline, "Who is next in line, our kids or global citizens?" And he wrote, quote, "In the next couple of months, the U.S. will have vaccinated every adult who wants one. What comes after this? Pfizer has released results from a randomized trial powered for immunologic endpoints that claim efficacy in 12 to 15-year-olds. At the same time, millions of elderly individuals in Africa, Asia, and South America remain unvaccinated. Soon, even younger American kids will be given the green light. The risk of dying from COVID-19 is incredibly low in children and adolescents. We are nearing a situation where our actions will be scrutinized by future generations. Will the U.S. embark on a campaign to vaccinate our children who face staggeringly low risks of bad outcomes from COVID? Or will we commit our efforts to saving tens of millions of older individuals who, by sheer chance, have been born in nations that lack the resources of ours? I believe that the right answer in all vaccination questions is to do what saves the most lives. A clear opportunity has presented itself. Let's make the smart choice," end quote. What do you think, Marjorie?
Well, so that's the obvious observation. Are the borders morally relevant? And the author is saying, no, they're not. And I think that's the right response, is that that's not. And so how do you manage this, given that the borders are not morally relevant? And the author that you quoted talks about distinctions between what is the consequence of the illness. And so there are many that argue for a fair priorities for residents framework, which is a framework that allows for governments to allow to retain vaccine doses where they're able to procure them for their own residents up to the point at which their society is no longer experiencing crisis-level mortality. And realize that's a focus on crisis-level mortality, not minor illness. And so at that point, there's an imperative to get the vaccines to those who are at a level where they're facing crisis-level mortality.
Okay, and if that borders question is answered in that fashion, then the question becomes, when it comes to an ethical choice, who is responsible, maybe the wrong word? I'm thinking of parents, because my guess, Dr. Shaw, is that we're going to see authorization come for younger children, maybe sometime in the fall or winter, and I'll ask Drs. Branch and Falsey about that coming up here. But when that comes, and it will come, when that comes, you may have parents. I mean, my son's 9. I'm thinking about this right now. He definitely wants a vaccine, and I want it for him. But I think if you gave me the policy-making choice, especially at a perhaps a national level, I would say he should wait. I mean, there are vulnerable people dying in other countries, and his risk factor is much, much lower. So I think he should wait. But I'm not the one making that call. And if there's a vaccine stock sitting here and it's set aside for American kids, is it unethical of me to say, look, I'm not making the decision on where the vaccines are currently being deployed, so I think I'll take him to get vaccinated. Should I wait? I mean, how do you make that decision?
So you've just made the distinction that's important, which is that there's policy level decision and governmental action, and then there's individual action. And so you as a parent don't have the authority to decide where we're going to distribute our vaccines globally. What you do have the authority to decide is what you're going to do if there's a vaccine available for your family locally. And one of the things that we need to remember is every person vaccinated is better than not having somebody vaccinated. And so there is an argument that you should advocate for a global distribution, that you should make it known to your government that that's what you think is the right priorities for us. But it is not incumbent upon you to refuse to vaccinate somebody when there's a vaccine available that would otherwise not get used just because you believe it should have gone to somebody else.
And I appreciate that very much. And I also think that might feel a little reassuring for parents. There's a part of me that thinks, boy, that's just overly convenient because then I don't have. But I think it's probably true, right? I mean, in this case, this is one of those ethical cases where the mistake would be to hold people back from being vaccinated wherever the vaccines are sent. And I'm glad Dr. Shaw is raising that point here. More vaccinated people is better than fewer. Obviously, more of the vulnerable population vaccinated is better than fewer. But we're not all making that choice. And this is tough. And listeners, if you want to share feedback on this, especially if you're a parent and you think about this, we'd love to engage with that. Because I do think, as Dr. Shaw says, we're not policymakers, but we can let policymakers know how we feel. And this might be a moment to do that. Dr. Falsey, what do we know about kids and vaccines and what a likely timeline would be? Do we have a better handle on that yet?
Well, the 12 to 17-year-olds that they're approved for now, they're working their way down in age group. They age de-escalate. Those studies are ongoing. Will they be ready for approval, emergency use approval, before school starts, I think is the question everybody is asking. And I don't think so, but, they are coming along quite quickly. I can't give you an exact answer.
Okay. Anything you want to add, Dr. Branch?
I heard the 8 to 11 years old would be sort of the next age strata, and that seems to be moving along fairly well. And I think some of the projections for the Pfizer and Moderna data might be as early as the fall. So you know, it's encouraging. And then that those younger age groups underneath 8 and all the way down to 6 months.
Okay. So let's take our only break of the hour, and we'll take some of your phone calls. So if you're on the phone, we'll grab that call after this break. We've got emails to read, both with general questions on vaccines, what we know about them, and we're also talking about how people feel about the ethical choices that we're making. And I've already got an email on that that I'll share with Dr. Shaw on the other side of this break. Marjorie Shaw is a member of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee, and Drs. Falsey and Branch are here, co-directors of the URMC Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit. And we'll continue with your feedback next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about festivals that are still left on the calendar. And specifically, we're looking at the Puerto Rican Festival. The organizers were waiting to see what was going on with the pandemic, what they could still do, what the rules would be, and they are making their plans now. We'll get you updated on the Puerto Rican Festival. We'll talk about keeping the community safe during festival season, what's still on and off next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dave in Brockport writes to say he is a kidney transplant recipient and his wife was the donor. They both had Pfizer and want to know what are the recommendations for people who are immunocompromised regarding boosters. Dr. Branch?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, Evan?
Yeah, Dave says he's a kidney transplant recipient.
Oh.
And his wife was the donor. They've both had the Pfizer vaccine, and they're wondering if there are recommendations for people who are immunocompromised regarding future boosters.
No, we don't have any recommendations yet, unfortunately. There is some early data that is demonstrating that efficacy is lower in immunocompromised patients. But in a recent study from the UK, actually, the two-dose effectiveness is still between 73 and 75% with either Pfizer or AZ in immunocompromised patients, and that's not bad. And so I think there is this modest reduction compared to immunocompetent patients, but for now, I think they should just go ahead and get vaccinated. And then I think as more data is forthcoming, we'll be able to make recommendations on whether or not there's a way to see if they had a good response to vaccination and if they should get a booster shot.
All right, Steve writes to say, Evan, Joe Biden was elected to represent Americans. His first obligation is to his own citizens, not citizens from other countries. Steve is talking about vaccinations and vaccine stocks. Dr. Marjorie Shaw, what do you make of Steve's point that, hey, if Joe Biden and his administration are setting policy on where our vaccine supplies goes, he was elected to represent the American people, not the citizens of other countries.
Well, so President Biden has made the observation that even if you're going to focus just on American people and representing them and making sure that they're safe, the best way to do that is address the pandemic globally. And so that still remains. Americans wouldn't be safe if all Americans were vaccinated and nobody else in the world was. And so it goes back to the fair priorities model that we talked about, is that you can prioritize the residents of your political community, but that's not going to be what's in your political community's best interest to ignore the needs of the individuals that are outside of that political community.
I think there's two separate arguments there, though, and I'm glad you raised that point. When it comes to the kinds of policy that will stop this pandemic, will most effectively not only save lives around the world, but save lives in your own country, it's true. We don't want hotspots, outbreaks anywhere, because that increases the likelihood of new variants, new challenges. And what we want is to see this whole thing shut down as soon as we possibly can. So on the side of policy, you're right. But what about on the side of ethics? If Steve is arguing that this president should be concerned with the American people first here, setting aside the fact that your approach is actually better from a policy side. Is his ethical responsibility to American people first when people are dying?
So it's the responsibility is for the or for the individuals that live within his political community up to the point that the injury is greater to his to his community members. So it's the crisis level mortality. If Americans are experiencing crisis level mortality as a result of the virus, then his attention needs to be focused on addressing that. Once we reduce crisis level mortality in within our borders, then it makes more. Then there's an ethical imperative to help those other places that are experiencing crisis level mortality when we're not.
Listeners, 844-295-TALK. If you want to join the conversation, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And again, the email address is connections@WXXI.org. Christopher writes to say, we should go after the unvaccinated Americans. Have someone sit on their chest while someone sticks a needle in their arm and vaccinates them. Look, I understand the concern with some of the resistance that is still happening. And I know some people don't like the word resistance or even hesitancy. It is a choice that many American adults are still making not to get vaccinated. They're making that decision for a wide range of reasons. There's not just one. There's not just one method to convince them. Ross Douthat, a conservative columnist for The New York Times, wrote today that we ought to just pay people, put a price on it and give them money. Marjorie Shaw, what do you think about where we go next with that?
I had just a reaction to how strong everybody's views are about what we ought to do to solve this. and it's you made the observation.
I am
right?
not for sitting on people's chests and sticking needles in it. I am not. I will probably never get to that point. But.
Well, you made the observation that people are hesitant. The people who have not gotten the vaccine are hesitant for a variety of different reasons. And
sure.
Some are scientifically sound and some are not. And so it's really important that we respect people and respect their views and engage in productive conversations that is honest about what we know and what we don't know. I mean, I think what you're doing that work right now by having Drs. Branch and Dr. Falsley on the show. Let's make it clear this is a emerging research. Let's recognize that. But there are things that this research has told us, and the scientists can tell us what they've learned, and they can tell us what they're still in the process of learning. And we need to engage individuals in making choices. I worry about individuals who don't get the vaccine because those are the ones at greatest risk. I worry about individuals who might not be able to get the vaccine or who have gotten it but get less immunity because of, for example, the caller that you had in. And I think it's important that we take all of the decisions whether to get vaccinated or not takes into consideration not just the selves of the person making the decision but the consequences of that on the community.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Falsley, how do you feel about where we're going next with just – you know, how many people are vaccinated in this population and some of the efforts made to increase those numbers?
Well, I share your caller's frustration at times. We've worked very, very hard to produce safe and effective vaccines. But this is the reality that we live in. And as has been said several times, the reasons for people declining a vaccine are quite varied. And so we've now moved from big campaigns, I think, to more a community effort. And there's mistrust on all sides. And what you really need are community partners who believe in vaccination and who that community trusts to be your emissary to try to deal with some of the disinformation. But it's unfortunately going to require more a boots-on-the-ground approach, which is frustratingly slow.
Dr. Branch, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I get really frustrated with misinformation. I can accept someone not taking a vaccine because they've looked at the data, they've looked at the research, they're just uncomfortable with how new these vaccines are or that we're still learning about them. But I do get very frustrated with all of the misinformation that's out there. from sources that are just not reliable. And I think that that's been sort of the biggest struggle. So I'm interested in seeing if there is a government policy that can address that. But apart from that, I agree with Dr. Falzi. I do think it's going to take trusted community members and leaders to really get into communities, you know, faith-based communities, communities of different races and ethnic groups, and have conversations that include their perspective on vaccinations, on health, on scientists, on science, on medicine. And I think that's really the only thing that's going to sort of help us do better than we're doing now.
All right, let me get Jane in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Jane.
Oh, hi, Evan. How you doing?
I'm okay, you know. I mean, I always wish the world were in better shape, Jane, but we're doing our best.
Yeah, that's right. And what helps me is this little thing about we are all in this together. And so when you make choices of one group of people over another, it's not going to work because we're all tied to each other. But as far as children getting the vaccine, I think as soon as we know for sure that it's safe, I don't see why not. You wouldn't want your child to give that to anybody else. It's the same sort of merry-go-round. And you want your child to be able to see their grandparents, that sort of thing. So it opens up his life, keeps his life open a little bit, too. But, yes, and I do feel for India. And I think if there's anything possible that we can do, I think we should get at it, get, you know, do it. We're all in this together. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jane. I appreciate that. And I would love to hear Dr. Shaw's thoughts on that. Go ahead, Marjorie.
No, I just thought she articulated beautifully what I tried to say earlier. We're in it together. and there are reasons, locally to encourage vaccination for individuals who haven't been vaccinated here, as she articulated. It's the effect that it has to those in the community, which is why even though we need to vaccinate all over the world, if you have access to a vaccine, you should get it.
Marjorie, do you see a parallel? I was thinking about your comments earlier about the fact that even if you set ethics aside, we have a better chance of protecting our own citizens and having a healthier outcome if we try to vaccinate equitably around the world the most vulnerable populations. And that it hits me that climate change is pretty similar to that, that if we just think about what's happening here and we're pretty myopic about it, then the outcome, even in the long run, is not going to be as good for us. Do you see a parallel there?
I think it's a good analogy. I mean, it's your caller made the point. Jane made the point. We are all in this together. There are the boundaries that used to matter don't matter in the same way.
Yeah, and Dan writes to say, Evan, it's hilarious how obsessed with social justice the rollout of these shots was for a few weeks anyway. And now we're asking, as though it's a serious question, should we go ahead and max vaccinate a population who is specifically not at risk before offering the shots to actually vulnerable populations in other countries? And should we do this in order to bolster our country's public health prospects as though we exist in a vacuum? Will this defeat COVID? I mean, that's what we're struggling with, Dan. I don't know, Dr. Branch, if you can square up a couple of things, though. I mean, Dan is pointing out that if you go back to the winter, there was a lot of talk about social justice for good reason. There was a lot of talk about making sure that the vaccines didn't just go to the rich and white and those with resources. And so I think that we need to probably continue to have the mindset that says, is this equitable? Is this the right way of doing this? He also said, you know, the population that's not at risk, in other words, kids. Kids do really well with COVID. And again, that's a beautiful mystery that we're all still so grateful for. It's not that kids could never have a rough outcome with COVID. We're just grateful that it is rare. But I don't wonder if there's something you want to add to that, Dr. Branch.
You know, I'm really glad that Margie's on the show just because these ethical questions are so hard. I think to take it last to first in some of the points you brought out, mm-hmm. While kids, by and large, don't have severe illnesses, some do. And there's some recent data that's suggesting that kids will have symptoms for long, the so-called long-haul COVID symptoms that we don't know may affect development, it may affect learning, it could affect their long-term health. Like, there's so many things that we don't know. So I would never say kids are not at risk. I'd say that fortunately they don't get hospitalized as frequently as older adults. And then when they are severely ill and hospitalized, they, you know, some of them do die. And so any loss of life, any loss of a child's life to me is tragic. And so I would never say that we should not continue to study these vaccines and deploy them in every human person, child or adult, who will benefit. Having said that, you know, you're right, and the caller is right that certainly there are places in the world where people are dying in the thousands every day. You know, I just read a story that they estimate that the number of deaths from COVID in India might be as high as 3 million. That's just incredible to me that in less than a year, 3 million people would have died from this infection, and they have so much less vaccine available than we do. So clearly, I think the world, including the United States, has to make some policy changes that includes equitably sharing resources so that we can end the pandemic. And then my last thought about this is that the most recent variant of concern that's causing disease worldwide, including the United States, it's now the dominant variant in the United States, is twice as transmissible as the original strain of the virus, is the Delta variant. And that's a variant that was first isolated in another part of the world, in India, in fact. And so as long as the pandemic continues to rage unchecked in other parts of the world, those viruses will come to the United States. They may evade protection conferred by vaccines, and we will continue to see people get sick and die here in the United States as well. And so there is absolutely no way of ending the pandemic or even containing unnecessary deaths from COVID without having a worldwide strategy of vaccination. Hmm.
Tom in Pittsford on that subject on the phone next. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, Evan. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Listening to the conversation, this is fabulous. I'm actually one of Dr. Falti's study patients. But to just as a compliment or just an argument to one of the things you read off about America First and or American or vaccines should go to Americans first, I also kind of see this as a national security issue. If we share our vaccines with the world, the more secure our population is, the better our environment is, the more our supply chain issues go down. So, you know, you can be America First, but America First sometimes means helping your neighbor also. So I just wanted to pass that along to you.
Yeah, and Tom, before I just get a little feedback from the panel on that, let me just ask you, I mean, my own bias is I agree with you, not just because, as Marjorie Shaw said, it's better for us, and as you point out, it's better for our own citizens to see a worldwide strategy, but I also do think just ethically it's the right thing to do. But at the same time, I do think of the political realities and what the headlines look like. And how fast do you think we would see headlines in all kinds of media platforms that look like this? While millions of children wait for vaccines, Biden sends vaccine stockpile to Indonesia. Just imagine the political blowback. And I am not at all saying that's an excuse for not acting. I'm just saying that we are in a very, very ugly place, I think. And my guess is, in private quarters, that's probably a consideration in the White House and elsewhere, though I don't know for sure. What do you think, Tom?
I agree with that, although I will say, Evan, I probably never would see that headline on PBS or NPR, because headlines like that generate revenue for paid for for commercial networks that rely on that stuff. And, you know, that sometimes, you know, I know this is a very courageous thing for a political person to say is, well, tough doo-doo is the right thing to do. So, unfortunately, in the environment we live in, I'm a Navy guy. I should have said something else, but I don't want to get bleeped. So,
Listen, I appreciate the editing, and thank you for the phone call, Tom. Dr. Falzy, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we can distill it down in that the ethical choice here is the best choice for self-interest. That we're fortunate that in that, and
yeah.
that we can do more than one thing. That, you know, while this country is a little bit stalled in getting people vaccinated who can be, who just don't want to, we should be reaching out to other countries and redistributing it. As regarding children, you can still develop children's programs. The doses are lower. It just doesn't have to be either or. You got to try to do the best for the most amount of people.
Ethical choice. It happens to be the best choice, Marjorie Shaw. Wouldn't ethics be easy if it was always the self-interested choice was always the ethical choice, Marjorie?
Yeah, well, I actually like that the ethical choice is really always the best interest choice.
So, well, that's a good lesson to take from this, I should say. They're not mutually exclusive, but especially true in this case. Let me get Manuel in Rochester, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Manuel.
Yes, Mr. Dawson. I appreciate you touching on this subject because I believe it's very, very important, this pandemic and COVID. And I just wondered who names these, and it reminds me of how hurricanes are named, you know, at random, I imagine. And they've chosen to name this variant, which is already was noticed, I believe, at the end of last year, Delta, when it actually, it's originated from India, okay? And no one ever mentions that. And I know that United States considers India an ally, because a lot of media, even Trump, was getting Americans to focus on China. Yes, it originated there, but we haven't found out exactly yet where it came from, you know. In the Chinese, when you compare the Chinese system to the Indian system, that it's a caste system, and how they're treating its own citizens, hundreds of millions of its citizens there that are called Dalits or untouchables. I mean, mm-hmm. how this system of that is running the United States can ally itself, and Trump himself went there. Namaste and all this. I mean, he's a jingoistic. He thinks he pulled the wool over Americans, and he still has some control over Americans, but the system. I'm not talking about political
stuff,
you know. But this people are, and the people, this guy Biden, okay, who I don't consider to be, a person that a puppet. He's another puppet, just like Trump was, and Obama and Bush and all of them before, and Clinton's.
Well. Memo, just because we're going to run out of time, let me just jump in and say, first of all, the concern that you have with countries that maybe are not prioritizing the health of all of its citizens, with mass poverty, with poverty that is really, really condensed and packed and where vaccines travel. Not vaccines, where viruses travel. I think we should probably always question the numbers. And certainly, I don't think we're seeing the full picture of numbers of hospitalizations and deaths, sadly, from COVID. On the subject of where this virus came from, or the variation, this variant, you heard Dr. Branch mention earlier this hour that it originated in India. And Dr. Branch, the Delta is, I think this is just the new sort of international system of recognizing the variants by using this particular alphabet. Is that correct?
We don't really want to link a variant to a specific country. The only point in mentioning that the Delta variant was first isolated in India is to really highlight the fact that it is in fact a global pandemic, and everything that happens to our neighbors will in fact eventually affect us. But their variants continue to emerge, new strains of the virus, in every part of the world, including here in the United States. You know, just a few months ago, we had variants emerging from California and from New York City that were very concerning. And I think that that will continue to be untrue. But in populations where resources are so limited that 10% or less of their population is vaccinated, that's where you have the highest risks for more variants to emerge that are transmitted to other parts of the world. And so that's really the material point, is how do we end the pandemic? Well, we have to end it in the entire world, and that's the truth.
Manuel, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Falsey, 15 seconds. What's the biggest vaccine question you would like answered next?
You know, do we need specific vaccines for the variants, or is more better and a booster will help eventually?
And we're on our way to getting answers, and I know that you, Dr. Branch, and so many of your colleagues are doing wonderful work in that regard and answering questions from listeners, which continue to flow in. So I know you're busy, but thanks for making time for the program. Dr. Ann Falsey, wonderful having you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Angela Branch, always an honor to have you. Thank you.
Fun conversation as usual.
They are co-directors of the Vaccine and Treatment Evaluation Unit at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Dr. Marjorie Shaw, who's a member of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee, thank you for the wisdom and the expertise this hour. Thank you, Marjorie.
Yeah, thanks for including me.
More connections coming up in a moment.